Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
I am Michael Wangpa, and I'm the host of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. Today, we are going to explore maritime security in Africa. I am joined by retired Admiral Sir Philip Jones. Admiral Jones has had an illustrious career in the Navy that spans
over 40 years since he joined the Royal Navy in 1980 as a sub lieutenant. In December 2008, Admiral Jones was given command of the European Union's first naval task force assembled to protect international shipping off in the waters of Somalia. Philip, you've had an impressive career, and I'm excited to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure, Michael, and I'm looking forward to the event today. Thank you.
Great. So I'm going to start off by asking you, what is the marine landscape of Africa, and why is the maritime domain so important to Africa and to the rest of the world, to be honest?
Well, that's a very big question. And of course, as a European, I'm not the immediate expert on that, but I'll offer a couple of observations, if I may, based on the privilege I had of commanding the EU's counter-piracy operation off Somalia 15 years ago when we first began that operation, about the work that my headquarters and I did to try and understand the area we were operating in and how we could add value and how we could help in the counter-piracy challenge. And that work began with an analysis of why is this happening? What is the situation in the maritime waters immediately off the coast of, in this case, East Africa, but I think it applies to the whole of Africa too. And we did that by saying, what are the essential elements of maritime security that enable either an individual nation state or a collection of nation states brought together in an organization to provide sufficient security and integrity for their maritime industries to happen? And our judgment was that off the coast of Somalia in 2008, effective nationally controlled or wider organization controlled maritime security didn't exist. There was a fight for the soul of the state of Somalia, which at that stage didn't have a maritime dimension to it. So kind of anyone could do anything off the coast of Somalia, and there was nobody there to stop it. And that's the kind of conditions, the kind of vacuum, if you like, in the maritime domain that piracy and other elements of international maritime issues can come and fill that vacuum. It can be filled by maritime smuggling. It can be filled by illegal fishing. It can be filled by maritime counterterrorism. All of those things can come in if the essential elements of maritime security are not there. One of the things that has most impressed me about the evolution of that thinking in the 15 years since is how so many nations in Africa and also elsewhere learned the lessons of what had happened off the coast of Somalia in 2008 and have been working hard to establish those essential tenets of maritime security, both in their territorial waters, where it is absolutely vital to assert control over everything that happens, and then in those wider waters in which it's now possible under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea to claim exclusive economic rights, how you can have a chance of enforcing those such that your nation can get the benefits of the riches that are in the sea in that exclusive economic zone. If you don't have that, you're not enabling the state to draw the benefit of its waters, and you're creating a vacuum that others can come in and fill, and sometimes with illegal activity. So I think that's what we found off Somalia in 2008. And it's the evolution of African thinking on that maritime security that's been so positive and effective in the intervening period.
Oh, quite interesting. You quite touched on my second question. Speaking of devolution and transformation of maritime security in Africa, since 2008 till now, how would you rate that? How would you scale it? Do you think we still have threats? Do we have new threats? How has these threats or challenges evolved over time? And what are the opportunities that exist now?
Yeah, so firstly, that evolution has not been universal around the whole of the coast of Africa. There are some areas which were pretty good in 2008. I'm not for a minute trying to say that there was no decent maritime security anywhere. There absolutely was. Mm-hmm. There was a void off the coast of Somalia. But also what has happened is a reflection of the different components of that maritime security that have to happen. So, of course, in a very obvious way, you've got to have ships to do it, whether they be some of the larger warships, the frigate destroyer type ships that the European Union, NATO, and other organizations brought to bear against the pirates in those days, or whether it's smaller coastal patrol vessels, fishery protection vessels. And these can be, of course, owned by a coastal or a maritime police force. They don't have to be Navy. So that's the first building block. You've got to have vessels that can go out and assert authority and control the space. But secondly, you've got to have a command and control organization that can make this happen effectively. You need some kind of maritime control center that can order which ships should be in which locations and when, and work through the issues of logistic sustainment, because they can't be out there all the time. If you can bring some kind of aviation component to that, that adds enormous value, because aircraft, whether jet or turboprop propel, can cover vast swathes of a maritime exclusive economic zone that ships just can't. And they can help coordinate how to pinpoint the ships into the right place to investigate illegal activity or to assert authority. But all of that needs a coordination, a maritime air sea coordination. And there are some components of the African coast that have got quite sophisticated elements of that in place already, much of the Mediterranean coast, and increasingly so the West African coast round into the Gulf of Guinea. But across the coast of Somalia, certainly in 2008, none of that was present. So we had to bring it in. So the EU and NATO deployed both warships and maritime patrol aircraft to try and assert that. But the additional thing on top of that, and this is what's often missed, even by us mariners, is you've got to have a really good intelligence network. You've got to be able to put your aircraft and your ships in the right place based on what your intelligence feed is telling you. And that can be both in the case of pirates: where are the pirate camps? How big are they? How capable are they of getting out to sea? And when are they likely to do that? Or in the case of potentially illegal fishing, where are these fishing fleets coming from? Because they're probably going to be from somewhere else in the world. When are they arriving? How large are they? How long are they going to stay? What techniques are they likely to employ? So you've got to kind of bring all of this together: intelligence, command and control, coordination, air and maritime assets, in order for a nation state to assert maritime security autonomy in its area. And there's some very good examples of where that's happening, but you can't build that up overnight. That's progressive. It takes time. It takes working with partners. And of course, it takes money.
Yeah. Speaking of working with partners, and speaking of having this integrated maritime global governance, how does Africa fit into, or how do they participate in shaping such policy, if it exists? And are there tensions and conflicts between Africa and the Eastern actors in the sense of African countries trying to exert their, you know, maritime authority over their, you know, over the domains, maritime domains. Do we see any sort of tensions, how do they shape, you know, disintegrated global governance management?
Yeah, I think it very much depends on the kind of relationships that exist between neighboring states at the point at which you start this journey into maritime security. So a very good example of where real progress has been made, because there is a perceived threat to all nation states in this region and a perceived benefit from operating together, are the West African littoral states, who have worked together to drive up the level of maritime security that can be achieved in the Gulf of Guinea. That's been a real success story. The Royal Navy and other like-minded navies in Europe and in Africa have been helping those West African states to do that. And that's a pretty effective network that's now been set up, and it has all the components of maritime security that I mentioned earlier, which is good, including the intelligence feed. But for that to happen, you've got to have all of those littoral states recognizing that they need to work together and achieve an element of collective maritime security that will work for all of them. Where that becomes difficult is where there are existing conflicts over ownership, either of land space or of water space, between some of those littoral states. Now, I'll give you a good example of where that breaks down, and not in Africa, but funnily enough, in Europe. So back in the 1970s, just before I joined the Royal Navy, the UK was in dispute with Iceland over control of fishing rights in the waters between the UK and Iceland. And this was at a time when the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea had recently been agreed, and the authority that states were given to push their exclusive economic zones out 200 miles from their coastline had just come into being. And of course, for areas that are rich in fishing, such as the waters of the North Atlantic between the UK and Iceland, this was really important. So it's fine if you're an island state that has no one else within 200 miles of you. You just claim your 200 miles and that's all good. But almost all states in the world are going to have some area where their 200 miles comes up against another country's 200 miles. And you then have to have a median line between the two, which is arbitrated and agreed at the UN, and then you have a portion of that 200 miles exactly in the same way that you will apportion territorial waters sometimes, where countries are less than 24 miles apart and they can't claim 12 miles each of territorial waters. The Dover Straits, the Straits mm-hmm. of Gibraltar, the Straits of Hormuz are very good examples where you have to come into compromise there. So the UK and Iceland took a while to agree how they would apportion control over fishing rights where their economic zones came together. Where you have areas of Africa where countries are in dispute over either water space or land space, then you're going to struggle to create those conditions. And you may find you just have one nation trying to assert maritime security over its own waters without cooperating with its partners. And even if they can reach an agreement over where the median line goes, if they're not cooperating over intelligence, not cooperating over shared use of maritime patrol aircraft and where their offshore patrol ships might go, then you're going to be less effective at maritime security. So as your question has implied, Michael, it's all about partnership with your with your neighboring states.
That's quite interesting. Speaking of that, I think the African Union has this this vision that they have for 2050 in terms of how they integrate the maritime strategy. But from 2008, when you were in charge of the European Naval Task Force, when Somalia as a case study, when it was near absent, the authority that over the seas. From then till now, how would you assess if I use Somalia as a case study, and you know, also other African countries, how would you assess their awareness of and response to the maritime threats and security in Africa?
I think it's come on in leaps and bounds, and I think the lesson of Somalia in 2008 is a really good one, and I think it's impressive the number of nation states who've learned the lesson of what happened, because I think the case of Somalia in 2008 was perhaps an extreme version of how the fragility in a state based on conflict within the state between different tribes, different components of the nation fighting for control, fighting for autonomy, which makes so many components of what makes a state work break down. And there are many of those inside all elements of statehood that others are far more expert than I am to observe. But the one I would observe is the effective loss of all control over activity right up to the shoreline. And this is really significant. This, we believe, in 2008 was the origin of piracy. So the people of a nation are not necessarily able to understand and follow closely disputes about fishing rights in exclusive economic zones, potentially hundreds of miles off the coastline. They can't see that. They don't feel that. Their own nation's fishing vessels that are maybe trying to exploit that and finding conflict with another nations are not necessarily coming from their ports. They might come from somewhere else in the country. It's not always a personal, visceral link with the people of that country. But in Somalia in 2008, it was, because there were coastal communities along that strip facing the Indian Ocean that had a tradition of fishing. A long tradition of fishing those rich waters and expecting that to be protected by the state. And suddenly, because the state had effectively collapsed, any capacity to do maritime security had collapsed, not out to 200 miles, but right up to the shoreline. And so those fishing communities could see foreign fishing fleets coming right into their territorial waters and taking their fish. And I think the rest of the world, probably the rest of Africa, was slow to recognize the impact that was having on the local coastal communities in Somalia. So they didn't need to read about that in newspapers or on their phones. They didn't need to hear about that from tales told in the fish markets from others about other nations taking their fish. They could sit in their coastal towns and they could see it happening. And in hindsight, we think that was the origin of why they started to pirate. They were pirating the fishing vessels that were taking their fish. And then they suddenly realized how profitable, how successful, how easy that was. And so they started pushing further out and taking bigger ships. So that's how law and order at sea can break down. We often talk about the breakdown of law and order on land. That's how law and order at sea breaks down, because there's a vacuum of maritime security. So I think the lesson of that is, don't let that happen. It's the responsibility of a nation state to be able to enforce, at the very least, your territorial waters. And every nation has the right to claim 12 miles of those. So you can control exclusively what happens within those waters. Nobody can come in unless they're just taking innocent passage, unless they've asked you to do so. And I think it's been impressive to see that progressively elements of the Somali state, the bits that are up in the Gulf of Aden, Somaliland and Puntland, started to establish basic maritime security protocols and had vessels in which they could enforce that. And that enabled pirates to be gradually driven out of the Gulf of Aden. They left there before they left the Indian Ocean, the eastern coast of Somalia. And it was largely because of the indigenous capability of Puntland and Somaliland to start policing their own waters. The lesson for that is extensive. That's been the essence of the success of West Africa, those nation states working together to reassert control of the various areas of territorial water owned by Nigeria, by Ghana, by Togo, by Cote d'Ivoire, by Benin, and going right the way around towards Liberia and on up. They've done that individually and collectively and shown their people that they can control those waters. And that's the key tenet of the movements that have taken place in the last 15 years to me.
Oh, interesting. If I bring it to, if I introduce geopolitical competitions, so in the, we've seen that naturally or traditionally, African states have agreements with the West, whether it be the EU or the US or UK. But in recent times, we've seen new actors such as China scaling up our military. I think in the Indian Ocean in East Africa, we see China building harbors in there. And I think a few years ago, China had the first naval training in the Gulf of Guinea. How do you view this, considering the ideological differences and geopolitical competition between China and the West? What implication does this have for maritime security in Africa, if any?
I think the implications are quite profound. But to start with, I'm not at all surprised that it's happening this way. I've long been a proponent of the capacity of the maritime to act as a bridge builder between different nations, different blocks of nations, and also as a mechanism through which you can test the ability for a nation to assert itself in a way that you couldn't really get away with on the land or even in the air, but you can do it at sea because it's a slightly less contested space, and because of the existence of the high seas, which don't really exist on land, everybody owns some bit of the landmass. Not everybody owns every bit of the ocean. So lots of nations, and I'm speaking historically now, traditionally have used the sea as a way of asserting some degree of authority and autonomy. And of course, the Chinese had been doing that 400 or 500 years ago, with a very effective international trading policy, which took their ships all the way across the Indian Ocean and through vast swathes of the Pacific Ocean. And they understood the significance of being able to own and secure and use trading routes like that. So what the Chinese have been doing in the last 15 to 20 years is just reasserting that authority, reasserting that capacity to deploy at range and influence events. And it was quite interesting in the early stages of setting up our EU headquarters in 2008 that representatives from the People's Liberation Army Navy, the PLAN, came to our headquarters to try and understand how we were doing this. How can a bunch of European nations that are concerned about piracy off the coast of Somalia at almost no notice deploy capability over thousands of miles into the Indian Ocean, warships and vessel protection detachments, maritime patrol aircraft, an intelligence network, utilizing logistic hubs in the region to sustain their ships? How can you do this? And they learned quite a lot from our headquarters about how to do it and started deploying their own counter-piracy task groups into the region, and started to understand how interaction with other maritime forces could work. And they are very fast learners, and they use that, I think, as a vehicle to understand the opportunities and the constraints of deploying their maritime forces globally. Now, since then, they've done that much more effectively. They deploy far more widely. They deploy more regularly. And they have started to establish these Belt and Road centers that they will use as their principal conduits of maritime trade. I think that's probably had a more profound effect on Africa than in any other part of the world, because a lot of these Belt and Road hubs are in Africa, and the Chinese have poured enormous effort into making them successful and making them work, enabling the nation state in which they have invested to see the benefit of doing it. Where it's going to lead is an interesting question. And there are those who say, they're not doing anything that the Western trading nations are not doing. Others are more suspicious about where that's leading. And I think the jury is still out, as it were, and there are people who sit on both sides of that geopolitical divide. But it's certainly been rapid. It's certainly been effective. And it's probably worth making the point that it's principally geared towards wider Chinese geopolitical aims. than it is to a sort of altruistic approach to let's help African coastal trade doing this. So that's my take on what China are up to.
Okay, that's quite interesting. And if we look at how do we consider Africa neutral in terms of what role they play in this trade? Because we've looked at, despite having these enormous, marine resources, in the continent, it does seem that Africa itself contributes very, very minimal to the global maritime trade. And some have said maybe it's due to sea blindness. And if I link that up to what you said about in Somalia in 2008 and the absence of government in the sea created the incentive or created the space for criminal elements to exploit that absence. So do you think it's just down to lack of capacity or lack of to an absence, or is it really due to like sea blindness or due to like Africa not being aware of the resources they have and how best they can trade even among themselves, or improve on contributing to the global trade?
Yeah, I agree with you, Michael. I think sea blindness is alive and well in the world of 2023. If I begin an analysis of how I think it affects Africa with how I think it affects UK, you would think a small island nation off the northwest coast of UK that has a link with the sea as a method that shaped its history, its evolution over hundreds of years, would be very focused on the importance of the sea, not just in its history, but in its current day state and in its future. When I was serving in the Royal Navy, and indeed many cases subsequently, I used to trot out the statistics about how much of our trade arrives and leaves in the UK by sea. How much of our national GDP is shaped by our maritime domain. But it's extraordinary how difficult it is for that to penetrate into the heart of a nation that just doesn't really reflect on that. Unless you live very close to the sea, people don't really think about it. I'm convinced the vast majority of people in the UK think the bulk of our trade arrives and leaves either by the Channel Tunnel or by air. And it's extraordinary that the fact that it's about 85% arrives by sea. A similar statistic applies, of course, to the way in which the world is now sustained through internet connectivity and through cable, and how much of those are on the sea as well. It's a similar percentage passes on under ocean cables, not through satellite linkages. And again, people don't recognize that too. So it's a universal problem to get people to recognize the importance of the sea. And the other reason this isn't helped is these days maritime trade is done in vessels that are getting larger and larger all the time. One of the things I've done since leaving the Navy is I'm on the board of the Port of London Authority, which is still the biggest port in the UK. And I sometimes go out and see our pilots bringing in and out of the ports on the Thames these enormous container ships that are bringing the bulk of our trade in and out. And similar ports that I know exist in many areas around the coast of Africa too. But because these container ships are so big, because the movement of containers on and off them and onto the lorries and the trains that will carry them into the hinterland of countries is so sensitive, has such an element of security attached to it because it's so expensive, but also because it's so dangerous. It's all happening in enormous ports behind barbed wire and high fences with very few people involved, because so much of it is automated these days. It's quite difficult for the people of a country to see maritime trade happening, because it's happening in huge ports they can't get to, which are now being almost deliberately built away from centers of population because they need space to expand. They need space for large roads and railway lines to come in and move the trade away. And they need access to deep waters for these ever larger ships to come in. So Sea blindness, I think, is inherent in all populations who don't live on or very close to the sea. And it's being exacerbated by the sense that both global trade and global internet traffic travel somehow by air and not by sea. And then by the inability to see this trade happening with your own eyes. You know, so few people are involved in it. The thousands of people who used to work in ports are now being replaced by a couple of people driving huge cranes and huge trucks that move these things around. So I'm not an expert in exactly how that applies in each of the major littoral countries of Africa, but I've seen a couple of them and certainly know some of the ports are exactly as I've just described. So it's quite hard for people to see the opportunities they're missing. They think of trade as being something that happens between fellow African nations, and somehow that the foreign trade, the international trade, is going to be controlled by other people. It's going to be large shipping lines that control global maritime trade, that they have to make the investment, they'll get all the profits, and it's quite hard for the individual state to see the benefit. So I think, you know, there's more to be done to understand how to exploit the maritime for the benefit of a nation's GDP, and that applies almost universally, almost any country in the world.
Amazing. Speaking of that intersection, that connection between land and sea, in the you mentioned the effective role that the Air Force or the aircraft can play in terms of helping the Navy in terms of scanning the sea for some of these criminal elements. But one other thing I think what you've not mentioned is also how that interlinks with the land as well, because most of these criminal elements or criminal activities that happen in the sea, you know, they take off from the land, they start from planning in the land and, you know, before they've been executed in the sea. Is there also a relationship or is there like a cooperation between the Navy and, you know, in the land? Does the work of the Navy what implications or what, you know, complications have you experienced during your time?
Yeah, that's a really important point, Michael. I think that has to happen. When you talk about the interaction between maritime security and what vessels can do at sea and aircraft in the air and what's happening on the land, I don't necessarily mean interaction with military land forces. A lot of where I've seen really effective coordination between maritime security organizations and what's happening on the land is with police forces, because it's extraordinary how little visibility there can often be and how little coordination there can be between activity on a nation's landmass and activity in its territorial waters. Again, the UK example is the one I know best. There, when I was leading the Royal Navy, we were looking for ways of enhancing both our protection of UK fishing close in at a time when we were in dispute with some of our European neighbours about access to fishing stocks, and at the same time try to work with authorities on the land to control the movement of terrorists. And when we were worried about terrorists getting into the country, and if they worked out, it was really difficult to arrive by air because of all the security protocols that surround air travel. We were worried they were going to try and get into the country by sea, where it's much easier to slip in a yacht or a small coastal vessel into a secluded area of the coastline and not be detected. So you need really effective coordination to say, you know, if you think someone's moving by sea, but you're not quite sure where they're going to land, how can you create the capability to alert land forces to look for them, to detect them, and to, if necessary, arrest them? And vice versa, if you think someone might be trying to slip away by sea, but not through a main port, how you can coordinate your assets to be able to cover a coastline where there are a number of ways in which people can try and escape out to sea. The more fractured the coastline, the harder that becomes. So any coastline that has lots of islands, lots of inlets, lots of bays, lots of rivers going up into the landmass, it's much easier to move people discreetly around. So that coordination is, in my view, one of the hardest to achieve, not least because creating a relationship between a navy and maybe a coast guard with police forces on the land is not instinctive. Most police forces don't think that way. But if you can do it, you can achieve huge effect. I'll give you a good example of where we drove change in the UK. Leading up to the Olympic Games in London in 2012, and the fact that, as with most nations that host the Olympic Games, the sports take part in all sorts of areas of your country, not just in the city that's the main host, particularly the waterborne activities. So, you know, we had a lot of activity taking place in London, of course, but we had all the sailing activity taking place on the South Coast and, you know, other areas too. And we were trying to work with all of the police forces that had a coastline that was going to have some element of Olympic activity happening to work out a way of coordinating with us so we could do maritime security. In some cases, that was very straightforward because if it's a police force that has a major naval base in it, then they're very focused on that, and we could, and they have their own maritime forces. They can coordinate very effectively. There are others that had no visibility at all of what happened beyond the high water mark. You know, the sea was just an unknown to them. Other people worry about that, and we had to work with them to try and integrate a sense of coordinated authority. Now, you know, not every state in Africa has got to worry about that degree of incursion of potential terrorists onto their land who might threaten an Olympic Games. So, you know, that was just an example. But what I hope I have shown is, A, how important it is, B, how difficult it is, particularly if the coastline is broken up by deltas and islands and inlets. I think a particularly good example I'm aware of is the Niger Delta. That's an incredibly difficult water space to police and to get proper coordination between maritime forces and land forces to stop illegal activity taking place. It's one of the hardest things to try and achieve.
Yes, that's quite interesting that you'd mentioned the Niger Delta. But I was looking if you could take, lastly, if you take like a general view, or if you're going to advise on what needs to happen. So first, at the international level, at the global level, looking at Africa and the rest in terms of, and then at the continental level, and then sub-regional level, what needs to happen to, in order to accomplish, you know, a very viable, you know, maritime security, and also looking at the capacity of African navies, you know, what is the international, are they being built, are they being how effective are they, what needs to be done, what role does the EU, the West, the international community have to play, how does the AU, for instance, and other regional economic communities in Africa, what role do they have to play in order to have an effective, you know, maritime governance and security?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. That's a really good question. And you're right to imply, I think it's got several layers to it. So starting at the top with the United Nations, the global perspective and how maritime nations can draw from that, there is in existence a substantial amount of international maritime law which everyone can and should be using in order to achieve the effect they want to achieve in the waters they're allowed to claim. The UN Convention on Law of the Sea makes it very clear what you can and can't do, both on the high seas, in territorial waters, and in exclusive economic zones. And a phrase that is used extensively, perhaps particularly to police the maritime domains of the world, is the rules-based international system, a phrase that sometimes falls into disrepute because people want to challenge those and say, well, you know, we weren't around when those rules were made. You know, we'd quite like to have a bigger say in this. But that all cascades from the creation of the United Nations in 1949 the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and the substantial body of international maritime law that exists for any state to employ. So whatever your circumstances, whether you're a small island who can easily claim a 200-mile exclusive economic zone, whether you have to arbitrate with a fellow state who's close by to have a median line because you can't quite claim the whole 200, or maybe even you're a nation that has a significant international waterway passing through where you can't even claim the 12 miles territorial seas, you have to have a lot of foreign passing through, you can use that body of international maritime law in order to make the claims that are appropriate for you to claim. And there are courts in which you can take your cases for appealing. And in some areas of the world where there is genuine dispute over that, there is evidence of the UN being powerful and being assertive in supporting local littoral states. The South China Sea is a very good example of that, where UN arbitration in favor of states like the Philippines, Vietnam and the like over claims that China is making over its access to waters in the South China Sea is a good example of that. But who's going to enforce that? The UN doesn't have its own armed forces. It doesn't have its own navy. It doesn't enforce that at the macro global level. So you then come down to collections of states who can work together to collectively help assert those rights in their particular region. And there are examples of that all over the world. NATO does that very effectively in North Atlantic and European waters. The US-led Combined Maritime Forces organization based in Bahrain, which looks across the whole of the Gulf and Indian Ocean region, that was one of the organizations that produced a counter-piracy task force in 2008, working alongside NATO and the EU. They will certainly look to assert those rights, particularly over some of the choke points that are significant for that region, such as the Straits of Hormuz, the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb, and the Suez Canal. And then the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, is an important body for enabling nation states to work together and strengthen each other's resolve to enforce those UN rules in their region. The African Union has the opportunity to do that for African waters. I'm not an expert on how much they're doing that. I haven't seen much evidence of whether they are asserting themselves in the maritime domain in a way I know they have very powerfully to try and resist conflict and strengthen individual states within Africa. But I think if they're not, then maybe they should be, and look at ways to enable nations to come together and work collectively. And then ultimately, it's down to the individual state. Most of those collective organizations I've described will be supportive of nations that are working hard to help themselves. ASEAN and the UN have come to the assistance of the Philippines, Vietnam, and others in the South China Sea because they are asserting themselves, that they are putting in the hard yards, if you like. They're sending their patrol vessels to sea. They're going to the UN courts to make their claims. They're looking to find common cause with their neighbors to help in this. So I think it's never a good idea for a nation just to sit back and say, we'll let others do this work. We'll let our neighbors take charge here. We'll let an international organization come in and run this. Ultimately, if a government works out, it's in their nation state's interest to be able to assert authority in the waters the UN enables them to claim in order to improve that the take from the resources that they have in their exclusive economic zone, and to make sure that illegal activity doesn't happen in their waters. You've got to be seen to do a piece of it yourself. And I think that so there's an obligation at national level, there's an obligation at regional organization level, and there's an obligation to use the assets of the United Nations. So it's a collective piece.
Oh, thank you very, very much, Philip, for your illuminating insight into maritime security. Like you rightly said, it's ultimately is a collective effort. It's also nation states also need to to show commitment, but ultimately we need more cooperation in dealing with the maritime challenges that we face, and also in exploiting the opportunities that it presents. We really appreciate your insights and you joining us today. Thank you very, very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome. Assessment of maritime security in Africa and in the globe. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks.